Blog Talk Radio.
All right, welcome to today's U College Sports Talk. Our blog talk radio. We're going to talk about a bunch of college basketball and college football here over the next hour. Let's get our first caller in. Hey, Bobby, how's it going?
Hey, Colin, good. How are you?
Doing pretty well. So we'll start things off on kind of the downside. We've had a lot of suspensions lately, and I think we should be getting Bevin here pretty soon as well. But want to get your thoughts. One, I mean, we had the Sterling Gibbs suspension earlier this week, but Seton Hall, you pretty much knew they weren't going in the direction of making the tournament. Probably not going to affect them too much. Even if they go on a late run, it's really going to be tough for them to make it. Louisville, on the other hand, is going in that direction with the tournament, and you had Chris Jones getting suspended, one of those indefinite suspensions. Do you think if this is more than just the Syracuse game tonight, this could really affect Louisville and their chances of making a run in the tournament? Chris Jones is one of those guys who has a deadly mid-range game that normally comes up big in tournament games.
I think that's quick. Name somebody else on that team who can score besides Jones, Montrezl Harrell, or Terry Rozier. The correct answer is nobody. So you take away a team that can't score, you take away one of their three options. I mean, maybe Wayne Blackshear closes his eyes and makes a couple threes and a half. But other than that, they don't have any scoring options. So, yeah, this is a massive suspension. That's not going to get a whole lot of news because, you know, he's not the most known player on his team. Louisville's kind of been up and down lately. So it's going to fly a little bit under the radar. In terms of newsworthy, but it's a massive suspension if it is more than just the Syracuse game. And the Syracuse game is going to mean a lot, too, because it's on the road. You know, Syracuse is a decent team, and this is a game that Louisville needs to win, especially to kind of stay in that the contention for top three in the ACC.
Yeah, I definitely think Syracuse is dangerous. They're not fighting for a tournament spot anymore with their sanctions. But you know, guys like Rakeem Christmas and Syracuse would love to get a win like that, especially since they can't go to the postseason. Let's get Bev on the line here. Hey, Bev, how's it going?
Yeah. Hey, guys. How you doing? Sorry for the delay.
No worries. We're just talking about the Chris Jones suspension. Really what it means for Louisville, if it is beyond just the Syracuse game tonight, you know, if it affects their chances in the tournament. But do you think tonight it could make the difference, Bev, between a Louisville win and a loss, especially with them being on the road against Syracuse?
Yeah, I do, actually. And I don't know if that really comes down to, you know, like it. Let me think of a good way to phrase this. I think it may come down to play styles more than anything else. Like, Louisville doesn't – I mean, and y'all can disagree. Like Louisville really a big aspect of their offense was the fact that Chris Jones could make really, really tough jump shots, really, really hard, you know, mid-range shots that, you know, a lot of players just frankly can't make. I thought Louisville's, you know, success throughout the year, really, I think he was a great bailout guy for them.
Definitely a dangerous guy who can, like you said, beat you in the mid-range game. And Bobby said just before this, he's really a guy who can, anytime he wants, maybe the only player, you throw Terry Rozier in there as well, but can beat you off the dribble. And Louisville needs players like that with the struggles they've had on offense, definitely.
Yeah. Because they don't have an offense. I've never really seen an offense from them this year.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing they're doing as well as they are with how weak that offense has been at times. Big game tonight, though, is, of course, Duke UNC. I know, Bobby, in your neck of the woods, there's also the Cincinnati Xavier game tonight. You had an interesting article today, Bobby, how there's really not a lot of great college basketball rivalries left, and a lot of that is because it's so regional. What do you think it's going to take for some of these rivalries like Cincinnati Xavier to get more national appeal and also to start developing these rivalries? It seems like we're losing more than we're gaining right now. What do you think it's going to take to sort of gain that aspect of college basketball back again?
Well, I don't think we're going to see that aspect of college basketball back again. It's just the way, after conference realignment, it's just kind of how it is now with basketball being a little bit more regionalized. So, you know, it's like Cincinnati Xavier, I think, is currently, in terms of teams who currently play each other, so take out Kentucky versus Indiana, Syracuse versus Georgetown, it's the third best rivalry in college basketball that's still going on. But nobody really knows about it outside of this area, unless you talk about the fight from a couple years ago. Now, if both these teams are top 10 teams, yeah, it gets a little more pub. It's back on campus for the first time this year in a couple years. And it's coming in late February as opposed to December, which is unique. You don't see too many non-conference games late. But in terms of getting back on a national level, you're just not going to see it. College basketball is becoming a lot more regionalized. The rivalries mean a lot more to those kind of there as opposed to the national level. Sans the North Carolina Duke, which is the national key rivalry. But, yeah, it's just not going to see more than that.
Yeah, I don't know, Bev, if you had a chance to see Bobby's article. It went up about an hour ago, so you can check it out on today's.
I've actually been writing one, so no.
There you go. He actually ranked the best rivalries in college basketball right now, and it is a good point. A lot of great rivalries don't happen as often or really at all anymore. But he did have Kentucky-Louisville number one.
Conference realignment has ruined everything.
So do you think Duke UNC is the number one rivalry in college basketball?
No.
Does that get the nod over Louisville Kentucky? What's your take on the game, the rivalry tonight? Is it number one?
Yeah, I mean, I'm also biased because I'm an ACC guy. I grew up a UVA fan, and then I went to Wake. I mean, I think Duke UNC is the best rivalry, maybe in all of sports, just because of the proximity of the two teams. The number of great players to have played there. I mean, I definitely think – what am I trying to say? I definitely think Duke Carolina is the best. They really, really hate each other.
I don't think that's the case. I think
really?
To me – and I grew up an ACC fan. I grew up a Wake Forest fan, went to Kentucky. So I've seen both worlds. And to me, the national level, it's Carolina-Duke. But – in terms of pure hatred, it's Kentucky-Louisville. I mean, there's just nothing else besides basketball between those two schools or in the entire area. Carolina is a little bit more diverse. So.
Recently, they have been more successful as well. I mean, you're choosing between, top programs.
That's true.
Right.
The most prestigious programs in the nation. But recently, Louisville and Kentucky have been a little better than Duke and UNC. So – It probably comes down to that.
One time a year, which I think factors a little bit more. You know, that one-time meeting just has a little bit more meaning to it because you don't have that, well, we'll get them at our place, or we still have one more game against them.
Right. So, Bobby, who do you think wins
tonight? Also take it another way because, it's the kind of rivalry that really can, be a split in the season, and then adding to that, you know, sometimes even they meet a third time in the ACC tournament, you know, to really determine, you know, everything. And that everything in terms of the ACC. So, I do think Kentucky-Louisville right now is probably the better rivalry because I think those teams are better because Louisville is better than Carolina, even though they split this year. I do think Louisville is better, not talent-wise. I just think they're a better team. And obviously Kentucky is everybody. So, but, I historically UNC and Duke, the best rivalry ever. But for right now, you may actually be right. I hadn't thought about it a whole lot, but just in terms of quality of teams, it's hard to say Kentucky-Louisville isn't the best rivalry right now.
It's definitely a two-horse race, at least I think at the moment, between those two games. But in terms of tonight, Bobby, who do you think is going to win between UNC and Duke? Is it going to be, you know, get to 80 points or else you have no chance, or is it going to be more than just a track meet?
I think it's going to be Duke in a blowout. I'm not that high on North Carolina right now. They continue just to be an incredibly dumb team and lose games like they do to Pittsburgh. Plus, it's at Cameron. I just don't see Carolina going in and winning. I think it's going to be like a 12, 13-point game, but not one that's really ever in question. And, I don't know how Duke's going to match up. I'm sorry, I don't know how Carolina's going to match up with Duke's two guards. I think Duke matches up a little bit better. They take away Carolina's X factor with J.P. Tokoto and his athleticism. Justice Winslow takes that away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Bev, do you think the only way UNC wins is if Marcus Page just goes off, or is this a game where they can compete and get a contribution from a lot of guys, or is it really just a Marcus Page or else deal?
I mean, obviously Marcus Page is going to be huge. I think he needs to score at least 25 points to give the team a chance to win. The only thing that Carolina has going for them is that they are good in the interior. I mean, they're huge, but at the same time, you know, you got Okafor and Jefferson. Carolina Carolina is deep down low. I think they have good players down low. And I think they can really use that to their advantage. But I think Duke is just – I think the difference, as Bobby said, are at the guard positions, you know. And just shooting. Duke can shoot the ball, and Carolina can't. Like, Carolina is abysmal at shooting the ball.
J.P. Tokoto is the worst jump shooter I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. Oh, hands down.
Between Louisville and North Carolina, the ACC really, you know, lacks some depth in the shooting department in terms of teams. But that'll definitely be a great game to watch. I'm sure everybody will be tuning into it, hopefully in addition to the Cincinnati Xavier game. But
Quinn Cook and Tyus Jones on offense, Winslow on defense, that'll be the difference makers. Those will be the difference makers, in my opinion. So,
tough to beat those guys.
Duke wins by 10, but it's not really close. UNC can win if Marcus Page gets 25-30. I'll stop talking now. Sorry.
I mean, I would love to see Marcus Page just go off just for the entertainment value.
So would I.
But yeah, another team this week that's done pretty well. Had a good week. Michigan State, they do the same thing every year. Izzo's team struggles. He kind of gets mad at them like he did this year after the Navy game, and they struggle out the gate. And then, you know, come mid-February, they start to roll and then do really well in March. I saw Joe Lunardi in his latest bracketology has Michigan State as an 8 seed. And the first thing I thought was, can you imagine Michigan State playing a Duke or a Kentucky or something like that in the second round of the tournament? That would just be an awesome matchup. But Bobby, do you think this is just a good week from Michigan State? Because they've been kind of up and down all year. Are they going to go back down, or is this the start of that classic Tom Izzo team that peaks at the perfect time and can really make a deep run in the tournament?
It's a combination of both. They're definitely getting better. Don't get me wrong by that. They're improving. They're starting to find their identity. It was a good week, but it wasn't like they had incredible wins. I mean, they beat Ohio State at home. Ohio State's an average team that struggles on the road. And they beat Michigan, and Michigan is not the Michigan of the last couple of years. I'm pretty sure Michigan's starting about 4 walk-ons. so they're getting better. You know, I don't think they're going to be a threat. I think they'll end up higher than an 8 seed. I think they'll end up about a 6 seed. They have a pretty easy schedule on the way out, so they can kind of get a little bit inflated of a record. I think you'll see them as a 6 seed, but, I mean, yeah, they're getting better. Classic Izzo of improving as the year goes on. They're just, to be frank, they're just not as talented as other Izzo teams. So they don't have the capability to kind of be a Final Four threat. But yeah, you know, they'll finish like a 6 seed or go into the tournament as a 6 seed, win a game. If they get to the Sweet 16, it wouldn't be shocking. But, I mean, they're just not talented enough to be a Final Four threat.
Okay. So what if, Bev, if they do sort of come back down and don't finish great and stay in that 7 or 8 seed range, is there a team you think that's on that top line, whether it's a 1 seed or a 2 seed, one of those top teams in the nation that they could match up well with particularly and that they would really feel good against in the second round? Or what game would they be the biggest threat in?
Wow, that's actually, I mean, that's tough because, you know, it's like the only reason why we're talking about Michigan State potentially going deep in the tournament is because Tom is. I mean, there's literally no other reason for thinking that they're going to go deep.
It is the main
reason. Oh, it is. It is. I mean, Tom Izzo is incredible. But, not really. I mean, I think they could give some of those top teams some trouble, but I don't think. I don't think they beat anything. I think they would play. I think they would play UVA close, and I think they would play Gonzaga close, but I don't think they would win. You know, I think they would keep it within 6 or 7 points. Especially maybe against. See, it's hard to say because Gonzaga is really talented. They're really good.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm just thinking maybe because of Gonzaga's schedule, they would go up against Michigan State, and maybe they would come out flat just because they haven't played a team that good in a long time.
Right.
I mean, and I think UVA without Justin Anderson could be a really, really good game. But I think with Justin Anderson, I think UVA would win easily. But
it all depends how Justin Anderson looks when he comes back, too. We don't know. I mean, shooting game.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, what Justin Anderson comes back is – that's the biggest question in all of college basketball.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I agree with
that. If he comes back and is, you know, the same player he's been the last month before the injury, that would be scary for anybody in March, whether it's Michigan State or anyone, really.
Yeah.
We'll stay in those teams that could be, you know, 6 or so seeds in the tournament that could be really dangerous. Our latest what the heck is going on in the Big 12 segment that we seem to be doing a lot here on the podcast.
I hate the Big 12, but I love the Big 12.
They're so confusing. Oklahoma had a bad run there. I think they lost 4 or 5 games. Everybody was down on them and going, is this even a tournament team? And then they come right back and win 4 or 5 games, 4 out of their last 5 games. Is this, Bobby, a team that can make a run in the tournament, or is it just a matter of hot and cold, kind of like with Michigan State? And can they challenge somebody like a Kansas in the Big 12 tournament and really boost their seed to where maybe they don't have to play that higher seed in the second round?
Yeah, I think they can, because this isn't a typical, as I said again, this is, you know, like, it's not a typical Michigan State team because they're not talented. Well, it's not a typical Oklahoma team because they play defense. Ryan Spangler is a player who doesn't get credit for anything, but he's, like, close to a double-double guy. He can shoot. He's really good defensively in the post. And Lon Kruger might be a coach who people don't talk about in terms of great coaches, but he – I think he's a great coach. You know, they're balanced offensively and defensively. They have a couple go-to scorers in Tershawn Thomas in the post and Buddy Hield, who has a great mid-range game, can get to the rim. I think they can make a run. It's just crazy looking at their losses that they've gotten swept by Kansas State, lost to Creighton, and lost to Washington.
Yeah.
Because Creighton is not good.
No. No, they're not. I saw Creighton in person.
At all.
I saw Creighton in person when they were here at Xavier. And, yeah, they're not that good.
Creighton tricks people
out.
And played, you know,
for some
good games early tournament. Yeah. Bev, do you think there's anybody in the Big 12 that's going to be a threat to Kansas for the regular season title? I guess Oklahoma's included in that. Or have the Jayhawks pretty much locked it up? They did just lose and drop a Big 12 game, so has that opened the door now, or is it pretty much smooth sailing?
I think if it was earlier in the year, they could have maybe gone down, but I mean, they like the rest of their schedule is TCU at Kansas State. I'm looking at it, home against Texas, home against West Virginia, and at Oklahoma. I think they lose at Oklahoma, and that's the only other game they lose. And I mean, because of that, I think they win again. I think Ohio State has a chance if they win out, but. Yeah, I mean, I think Kansas wins again. It's going to be boring. They're going to win, as always. But the race for two will be fun. If we care about stuff like that.
I've been wanting to pick somebody other than Kansas all year. I was totally trying to do the trendy thing and just find that team that was going to knock off Kansas. And you just can't do it, you know? Every time it looks like there's a window, Kansas gets a big win. You know, Oklahoma or Iowa State has a bad loss, and you're just back to Kansas. Big 12 goes through Lawrence. So we'll go to from the Big 12 to another confusing conference. Not confusing in terms of who is at the top. That's definitely Kentucky and the SEC. But after Kentucky, you have all these teams that you don't really know what to do with, especially as it comes down to the SEC tournament and the NCAA tournament. Bobby, outside of Kentucky, who do you think is the SEC team that will do the best in March in the dance?
I think it's Arkansas. I think they've kind of solidified themselves as the second-best team in the SEC. They have, again, a great 1-2 combo, Bobby Portis and Michael Qualls. Michael Qualls is probably the most athletic player in college basketball. If you have a chance to YouTube his dunks, they're ridiculous. But they're experienced enough. They have that great 1-2 combo that can win games, that can play inside out. And it's not a great record, but for Arkansas it is. They're currently 5-4 on the road, which is huge because the biggest knock is they can't win away from Bud Walton. And they have a bad loss to Clemson on the road, but they have a couple wins against KenPom's top 50 teams. So that's a little bit of a mental thing, I think, that they're getting over. I think, you know, they're going to be, like we've kind of talked about, a 5-6 seed. But other than that, the SEC, they'll have a handful of teams in it, but you'll see a lot of early losses from the SEC. I don't think you'll see a run like Tennessee had last year.
Man, you're banking on Kentucky, the one time that the SEC really will probably have some good mid-range seeds, you're not buying it?
No, you're going to get a lot. I mean, because they've kind of beat up on each other throughout the year and a couple bad losses, but you'll get like Georgia, LSU, Texas A&M. They're all going to be seeded somewhere from 7 to 12. So, I mean, really, you know, if they play the seed, you win a game.
yeah.
You know, if they play above seed, okay, now you're in the Sweet 16. You know, LSU, again, if LSU wants to play, they can. Cause
yeah, they're pretty good.
I just don't buy into LSU playing consistent. They should play in the Big 12 with how confusing they are, because you have Jarrell Martin, Jordan Mickey, who, you know, I've gone on and on about as a 1-2 combo, and Keith Hornsby can shoot, so you kind of have to keep honest on him. But, you know, how they lose to Auburn, how they lose to Texas A&M at home, they just have some bad losses.
Yeah. All I'm saying is that nobody's talking about them. Ole Miss without Marshall Henderson is better than Ole Miss with Marshall Henderson. I mean, they have guys who can score.
Not as
score
entertaining.
And they have multiple options. That's true.
Hey,
nothing is
Marshall
entertaining.
Henderson got into a Sweet 16.
That's true. But I'm saying that I think that with the scores they have, they could go on a similar run and just get hot in the tournament.
They could. They're definitely a better overall team than the Marshall Henderson team.
Yeah. Definitely think that's the case. Bev, are you on Arkansas as well in terms of SEC teams not named Kentucky? Or you can't Ole Miss or LSU or somebody else? Haven't even thrown out Georgia or any of
the
other options.
I know this is going to sound harsh, but I don't even know if I'm on the Arkansas bandwagon. I think Kentucky is the only significant, legitimate, really, really good team in the SEC. I don't trust Arkansas because, as Bobby pointed out, they don't win away from home. And when the third best team in the SEC is Texas A&M, I mean, like record-wise, it's just kind of hard for me to believe in any team in the SEC. I think LSU is a good team. I think they're really talented. They're going to be really, really good next year. But, I mean,
right now,
in Georgia, I don't trust Georgia. Ole Miss, I kind of like Ole Miss, but I don't think they're that good. I don't think A&M is that good. I think
it's not that I trust Ole Miss, it's that I see them as a team that could easily go on a run just because they have scorers. We have just a little bit of time left for a hot take. One last question here. What's a team, Bobby, that you think is on the outside looking in right now in terms of the NCAA tournament that you think can go on a run late in the season here and get in?
Oh, man. So outside of the projections that can make a run to get in? You know what? If I didn't see that Dorian Finney-Smith got suspended, I would say Florida could just get hot in the SEC tournament. But I'm going to rule them out because of that suspension. The outside looking in, someone like Tulsa in the American, I think they're currently projected as a play-in game, so I'm not going to count that because that's not an actual NCAA tournament game. they have a strong backcourt. I could see them making a run in the American, winning the conference tournament. So a couple nice wins over SMU, Cincinnati, UConn. I could see them kind of making a run and then getting in as like a 10 seed.
Yeah, I could see it. All right, Bev, real quick, what's your team that's going to make a run?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's hard because the team I want to say could make a run to get in plays in a conference who probably will not get more than two teams in, and that's BYU, because I like BYU. I think they're good. I think Tyler Hawes is really, really good. The issue is I just don't think the WCC is going to get three teams in, because you got to put in St. Mary's in there. And obviously, Gonzaga.
They're definitely going to have to win the tournament, I think. I mean, unless they just get a couple big wins in the tournament, maybe Gonzaga, and then don't win it. But
another
I think
team to look at
is
Dayton.
They can make them up. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you just say Dayton?
Yeah.
Yes, I like Dayton.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we're going to get to some college football here. Thanks so much, guys, for calling in. Big announcement in the Today's U world. Andrew Beverly now has a Twitter. You can find him at Andrew_Bev and read all his stuff on Today's U. You can find Bobby there as well. His Twitter is at UKLefty22. Thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you all. See ya.
All right, let's get to some college football here. We'll get Ryan Wooden on the line. Hey, Ryan, how's it going?
Pretty good, Colin. How you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Let's also see if we can get Dustin. Hey, Dustin, how are you?
Hey, I'm great, Colin. How about yourself?
Doing pretty well. Just looking forward to the rivalry tonight in college basketball, but we've discussed that thoroughly. The last half hour, we'll get to some good college football talk here. I want to talk about a couple of your articles. We've had some great pieces the last week. Ryan, you had one that was sort of a reaction to this recruiting season and National Signing Day, and particularly Roquan Smith, who finally decided to commit to Georgia after he initially committed to UCLA, and then the coach who recruited him left, and he's from Georgia, so he decided to stay at home. But he ended up signing a financial aid agreement as opposed to a national letter of intent, just to catch everybody up. Do you think that's something that we could see more often? And if it is, how did it really get to that? You know, most people haven't really heard, oh, he didn't sign a letter of intent, he signed some other agreement. How did he get to the point where really that's an option, and do you think we'll see that more often in the future?
Well, to start, if we'll see it more frequently, I believe the answer to that question is yes. However, whether or not it's actually used effectively as a tool, that's to be debated. But, I mean, there is precedent for this going back to the mid-90s in college basketball. Guys like Ed O'Bannon, who did not sign national letter of intent. If you want something more recent, a guy like Brandon Jennings at UK opted not – or excuse me, Brandon Knight at UK opted not to sign a national letter of intent because he was worried about John Calipari potentially making a leap back to the NBA. And, you know, I think elite-level recruits will have an opportunity to use their financial aid agreement to give them a little bit of leverage in this scenario. I mean, there's nothing that says they have to sign a national letter of intent in order to be eligible to receive aid at these schools and go play on a full football scholarship. So elite-level recruits could ultimately tell colleges across the country, hey, I have no intention on signing a national letter of intent, sign multiple financial aid agreements to people if they really wanted to, and then not technically have to take anybody up on that offer until they physically enrolled in school. So, you know, like I said, I think top 100 or so recruits will have an opportunity to use that. Now, whether or not they will kind of be predicated on, you know, how we see the Roquan Smith situation play out and how we see a couple of other, you know, top 15 to 20 recruits who opt to use this play out. You know, it's a tricky situation because if you get somebody who's a little bit too far off the radar who attempts to tell colleges, you know, I'm not going to sign a national letter of intent, and there is a player of similar talent elsewhere who opts to sign a national letter of intent, and that takes kind of the instability out of it for colleges. I think you can see people shy away from certain recruits who decide to do it. But, you know, I do think because of the way the Roquan Smith situation played out and because of all the cloak and dagger type recruiting that we had in college football this year with position coaches leaving the day after National Signing Day or the week after National Signing Day, we'll see it become more prevalent.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point that it does empower recruits to they don't have to sign this letter of intent and therefore can open themselves or stay open and look at options for longer. Dustin, do you think on the other side of that is it not fair to these guys who aren't in the top 100 who maybe can't don't have that that liberty to sort of wait it out and see who all how badly schools want them. Is it unfair if this happens more often to guys who aren't these five-star recruits to you?
Well, I think that's what kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, the pay-for-play scenarios that we've talked about with college football and college basketball. Do you give it to the athletes that are putting butts in the bleachers, or do you properly compensate everybody that's on the roster? And then further along, do you go, you know, in the events in the sports of swimming and wrestling and women's basketball, do you compensate them or not? I think there's probably going to be some iffy situations that are going to come up. I think in any situation you're going to have that occur where fairness is going to come into play. Whether the NCAA tries to make some sort of regulation on it, I don't know. I think eventually if there are enough of the top-level talents, as Ryan talked about, the top 100 or so, if they start signing these financial aid agreements, I think you'll see the NCAA try to step in, and whether or not that means it's going to be, you know, free for everybody, or if it's going to be something along the lines of you have to sign some sort of letter of intent, and what the verbiage is in that, they try to reword that so maybe players can back out of that. I don't know, but I think it's going to be interesting to see how that develops, because that was something that I thought was relatively unique with the Roquan Smith situation, and we'll just see how it develops further down the line. But I think any time you have something that may separate top talent from just your average, ordinary two- or three-star recruit, I think there's going to be a fairness issue.
Yeah, it does almost seem like it's going in the direction of almost like players are sort of politicking, and, you know, anytime it's as big a business now as recruiting is, and you could say that from the school side, like I said, trying to put butts in seats, or even the coverage side. You know, today's U is right there. We cover recruiting a good bit. There's a lot of money going into it, and therefore, you know, there's almost this politicking aspect of it. So if you'd told somebody 20 years ago that would be the case, they might have called you crazy. But then again, if you had said 2 weeks ago, Little League, you know, politicking would be a huge issue, they probably would have called you crazy, but we saw that this past week. So it'll definitely be interesting to see if that trend continues or not. Dustin, you had a really good article today that was on FanRag, actually, about Brett Bielema and Arkansas. He's definitely building a program there, got to 7 wins this year. You look at their schedule and their season, and if they can close out a game here or there, maybe win a game that was close as well, that could have been a 10-win team. And yet the standards, as you were saying, are so high in the SEC that he really needs to win and win pretty big this year to feel safe moving forward for the next couple of years. Do you think that he needs to, at Arkansas, contend in the SEC West with those powers in order to feel good about his job after 2015?
I think Arkansas certainly can contend. I think they have a really good group of guys coming back. They've got 7 starters defensively coming back. They've got 9 guys offensively, including Brandon Allen and Jonathan Williams there at the quarterback and running back. So they'll have a pretty nice 1-2 punch. But again, the SEC is typically top to bottom the best conference in the country. Now, we saw that slide a little bit in the bowl season this year. So, but Arkansas did take care of Texas, so they were able to do their part. But the interesting thing about the SEC is, you know, it just never seems that even if you're showing improvement, I don't know if it ever seems to be quite good enough. And so that's why I you know, picked up that article. And that's not to say that Brett Bielema right now is on the hot seat or that he's going to lose his job if any you know, don't get to a 9 or 10 win season this year. But I think that if he does struggle and if they're at the 7-6, 8-5 mark, people will begin to question whether or not he is the right guy for the position, whether he, you know, needs to be in the Big Ten with that style of play, or if he can bring his style of play down to the SEC. I think Dan Enos from Central Michigan taking over the offensive coordinator position will be a big help for them as well. Interesting to see how that'll change things offensively. I think Arkansas is good enough, but if not, I wouldn't be surprised to see Arkansas fans and maybe some of the administration say, you know, you've got one more year to do what you told us you were going to do. I think Arkansas is capable of a 9-win season, but you just never know in the SEC.
Yeah, it definitely seems like the pressure, I mean, generally speaking, is higher on coaches in the SEC. Ryan, do you think that because we see, you know, conferences rise and fall over, you know, years and years, and the SEC has been sort of the standard the last few years, do you think coaches in the future could stay away from the SEC because of that lack of job security? The conference has sort of been known for tossing coaches out unless they're basically living legends. Do you think we could see the coaches start to stay away from the SEC and maybe even the conference start to slip because of that?
I really don't, and it's because the SEC has been such a proving ground for coaching staffs over the course of the last, you know, 20 years and beyond. I mean, any coach that's going to shy away from the competition level that the SEC brings to the table probably isn't, you know, really well suited to compete at a high national level to begin with. So, you know, if they're genuinely concerned with how difficult it is to be in the SEC, they don't necessarily have the right temperament to compete in the SEC to begin with. So the guys who want to be here are the guys who want to go out and prove themselves against the best on a week-to-week basis. And, you know, kind of going back to the Arkansas point, I think outside of maybe Vanderbilt and maybe Kentucky, every single team in the SEC right now feels pretty good about where their program is or where their program is heading. So when you take a team like Arkansas or you take a team like Tennessee that are both coming off 7-6 seasons and have a ton of talent returning, we can definitely assume that the program's going in the right direction, and we think that they are going to get better with time and these recruiting classes coming in. However, in order for them to actually improve, we have to have some of these cemented powers decline in order for them to find the wins. When you've got 14 teams in the SEC and they're playing each other 8 games a season, so, you know, 112 games a year, there's only so many wins to be had on that schedule. So in order for Arkansas to be better, in order for Tennessee to be better, in order for a team like Kentucky to be better, with the recruiting classes that Mark Stoops have been better or have brought in, they've got to go out and beat traditional powers, and somebody has got to take a step down. And I think that's the problem in trying to project some of these teams right now.
Yeah, I think you're right in saying a lot of these programs in the SEC are going in the right direction and feel good about the future, which is kind of scary considering everyone, you know, during bowl season was saying, oh, you know, they're going to fade away. But you go to just about any program right now, and they're pretty happy with where they are. Looking to next season as well, some of the best moments early in the season are when that player you hadn't really heard of just has this huge game. And, of course, you know, early in the season, they'll put anybody on the Heisman watch as a Heisman candidate. Who, Dustin, do you think is a player who's not really a household name or even really expected to become a household name who could really shine next year? And we've seen it a lot recently with quarterbacks. You look at Trevon Boykin, really wasn't a big name. He was a wide receiver a couple seasons ago. You also have guys like Denard Robinson that's burst onto the scene at Michigan. Are there guys next year who you think would have similar paths, especially to start the season?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question because anytime you try to project who's going to come out of nowhere, it seems like there's going to be another guy that, you know, maybe was even on the sidelines a season ago who wasn't getting any playing time. But just some guys. You know, I like Corey Clement out of Wisconsin to get nearly 1,000 yards behind Melvin Gordon. That was a pretty remarkable feat, I thought, for him as a backup running back. And now with Paul Christ, who was a part of the Wisconsin team that were so good running the football under Brett Bielema, I think he's going to have a good opportunity there to really show off his talent and make a case for the Heisman run. And then I also like in the running back game, too, is the Samaje Perine from Oklahoma. I know he may be a little bit more of a household name just because he had that 427-yard game a week after Melvin Gordon breaks the LaDainian Tomlinson single-game rushing record. And then another guy I liked is on the defensive side is defensive back Will Likely from Maryland. The Terrapins don't have a great defense, but he was the only reason they were relevant a season ago. He had 6 interceptions and returned 2 of them for touchdowns in some pretty big games. So I like those 3 guys. I know they may not be a guy that you just sit back and say, well, I've never heard that name before. But I think those are guys that maybe not everybody, if you're just a casual fan, you may have heard the name mentioned, and they may burst onto the scene this season. But I think anytime you're looking at guys who may burst onto the scene, you have no clue who it is, because a lot of those guys were either on the sideline a season ago or they're in the incoming recruiting class.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting as we, try to project and look ahead to next season. So many of the names that keep coming up for 2015 in the fall are running backs. I really can't remember another season where running backs have been so hyped, well before the season even started. Ryan, do you see it as a running back dominated season, or are there guys we haven't heard of who are quarterbacks or wide receivers who could come out of nowhere, kind of like we've seen in the past? Are there any of those non-running back guys this year?
Well, I think when we start talking about like a running back dominated statistical season in college football, it's traditionally in lieu of a lack of significant big-name quarterbacks. And I think if you look at the classes that we had out this year, obviously we did have Marcus Mariota and Jameis Winston. But beyond that, if you even just look at what's coming up in the draft, there's not a ton of depth there at quarterback, guys that you're going to be interested in as first-round type draft picks. And, kind of projecting throughout the rest of college football, I mean, you look at a guy like Bryce Petty, who didn't have as big a year as we had expected, a guy like Brett Hundley, who didn't have as big a year as expected. There were a lot of quarterbacks who we expected to kind of take that next step and be in the Heisman Trophy conversation that just didn't. And in lieu of that, I think a lot of teams, elected to lean on their running game pretty heavily, and that's what led this to be pretty running back heavy. Now, will it be the same next year? I mean, given the strength of the running backs that we have coming back, I think it's definitely possible. A guy that I like a lot, if we're talking about guys to come off the radar, and, he's already had a couple of huge seasons statistically, but it's not a name that a lot of people talk about, is James Conner at Pittsburgh. It's just a big wrecking ball of a human being out there, put up big, big numbers against Iowa and big, big numbers against Duke earlier this year. And everything that Pittsburgh has coming back offensively with four starters on the offensive line, Chad Voidick at quarterback, Tyler Boyd at wide receiver. I like Connor's chances of having another really, really big year on a really solid offense with Pat Narduzzi taking over. And if Pat can, shore up the defense there, Pittsburgh can be someone to watch to win a few ball games in the ACC this year. But I think we'll definitely see a lot of big-name running backs with the Samaje Perines of the world and everybody that's coming back. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see who does step up and maybe, kind of take a little bit of that attention back to the quarterback position.
Yeah, I'm actually going to stay on the running backs, too. With my pick, I wanted to think or wanted to go with Deshaun Watson, but I really think he's kind of too much of a known quantity of what he did in his freshman season, even though he was injured. But another guy I think could do a lot of damage on Clemson's offense is Wayne Gallman, because defenses are going to be keying on stopping Watson throwing the ball and stopping him on those read options. So definitely a lot of running backs who could contend for the Heisman Trophy next year. Speaking of Heisman Trophy winners or former Heisman Trophy winners, you mentioned Ryan, Jameis Winston. He's still undecided on whether or not he's going to throw at the combine. And you look at that, the average fan might say he's a quarterback. I think they're supposed to throw the ball, show what they can do. But he's already established pretty well that he has great arm strength. He has great accuracy. Dustin, do you think it would be to his advantage not to throw at the combine, even with guys like Marcus Mariota throwing and really showing off those tools to the NFL scouts?
Well, when I read this, I thought it was similar to like a court hearing, in the fact that, when you have the suspect or the alleged guy in the court case, do you have him go up and plead his case, or do you have him sit silently and let the jury find out for themselves? It's an interesting aspect, although I think at this point, if you have nothing to hide, if you're Jameis Winston, and I think Tampa Bay is pretty set on taking him anyway, just for the hometown effect and that he comes out of a more pro-style offense. I throw the football, but I can't blame him for not doing it, because, like I said, I think he's locked in. So if there's no pressure to do it, why chance your opportunity to be the first-round draft pick, get a nice salary there with the Buccaneers before you even take a snap. So, you know, it's one of those things that it just kind of is different for me. I would want my quarterback to throw the football, but I think if he's a lock, I would just shut it down and not worry about throwing the football.
Yeah, you get the feeling that, you know, only bad things could happen if you were to throw the ball, if you had, I don't know, an off day or something like that. But all the mock drafts you're seeing now, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I haven't seen one in the last week, maybe two, that hasn't had Jameis Winston number one. In fact, I've seen some where Marcus Mariota is outside of the top five. Ryan, do you think he's a lock now for the number one draft pick? Is he going to Tampa Bay, or could a guy like Mariota, or if they wanted to trade it away, could that happen as well?
Well, I mean, given where we are in the year leading into all the draft coverage that we'll see over the course of the next 2 months, I think it's a little bit early to call anybody a lock at this stage of the game. I mean, we still have the combine, regardless of whether or not Jameis elects to throw. He's still got to go and do some form of measuring there, whether it's just literally height and weight or if he elects to participate in some of the position-specific drills, and whether or not he elects to throw either there or at his pro day. So there's a lot of things that can kind of, you know, see prospects kind of have their stock increase and prospects have their stock decrease. So a little early to say that he's a lock. I think he's the clear-cut favorite at this point. And I think it's because, you know, anytime that we have a guy like Mariota and a guy like Winston, these are two sensational football players. There's really no doubt about that. But any time that you can have the comfortability of a guy like Jameis, who played in a system that's going to be remarkably similar to what he winds up seeing, you know, his day one in NFL rookie minicamp, it's going to kind of give him a little bit of the learning curve advantage there. So I think that's why he's going to, you know, have the biggest advantage heading in, and I think he's the favorite, but it's still early to call him a lock by any shred.
Yeah, and I think with the off-the-field issues, you know, even if he had a great combine, just with the off-the-field issues, you never know if somebody's going to not take him or maybe take Marcus Mariota over him because of that. And Marcus Mariota at Oregon, they will need a replacement for him. We had Vernon Adams about a week ago now saying he's going to transfer to Oregon from the FCS. And the head coach there said that, you know, he doesn't want FCS programs to be treated like a farm system. And I saw that and kind of laughed at it and said, come on, guys. I mean, he's going to graduate. You got to sort of know that Oregon is more appealing. But, Dustin, do you see that as a potential problem because they don't have to sit out a year if they do graduate? Can you see players going to FCS schools and not really committing to that school by, I guess, hoping for at the end being able to play for a bigger program? Or is it really just one system and coach who is complaining because he's not going to get the quarterback?
Well, that's a question I don't know that I have the answer to. I do know that I understand where I believe it was Rob Ash who made the comments. I think I understand where he's coming from in the fact that, you know, hey, if I've got a really solid team and all my guys have done what they're supposed to do in the classroom, how is it that an outside source can come in and steal my talent that I'm supposed to have for another year? So I understand that kind of being picked apart. But at the same time, you've got to realize that, hey, there are bigger schools out there. There's more appealing things, and there's going to be a better way to get to the NFL. I mean, the guys that get to the NFL through the FCS are very rare these days. I mean, if you're on the FCS level and you're playing for especially a Power 5 conference team like Oregon, you're going to be on television some way, shape, or form every single week of the season, and that's great exposure if you're trying to get to the next level in a football uniform. And then again, with the FCS, the only way you're getting on the TV, really, at least on a national stage, is if you make the FCS playoffs and, you know, compete at that level. So I understand where they're coming from. I think that I don't know that you're going to be able to see that go away, just because if these kids are doing what they do in the classroom, they're getting their degree, they're doing everything that they ask, they put in plenty of time here at these FCS schools. I don't have a problem with it, but then again, I'm not coaching at the FCS level.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I kind of looked at it and thought that it could even be a really good thing for FCF schools if they become known for sort of after players graduate, you know, they play their last season at a place like Oregon. Or you said, I mean, he has the same option to go to the NFL. And if Vernon Adams were going to the NFL, they would be broadcasting that and saying it's a good thing. But he's when he goes to a bigger program, you know, they really don't like it. Ryan, do you think that it's actually a positive for some of these smaller schools? Is that something that they want to go to recruits with and say, hey, if you play here, you can go to the NFL or, you know, play here for a while and play at a much bigger program, sort of the way junior colleges have those selling points. Do you think that's something that FCS schools could do to really boost their recruiting classes?
It's something that they certainly could trumpet. I don't know that it's necessarily going to be something that they have exclusive rights to as a selling point, because the reality of the graduate transfer rules is it doesn't matter if you're playing at an FCS school or an FBS school or a Division II school. If you've graduated in whatever program it is that you're looking to pursue a graduate degree in, and basically you can make up whichever one it is that to make sure that your school doesn't have it so that you have an opt-out, you can go to another program without, you know, having to sit out a year. And that's, like I said, we've seen this happen not just with a kid like Vernon Adams jumping from Eastern Washington to Oregon, but we've seen Russell Wilson do it and jump from NC State to Wisconsin. So you can go from established program to established program, from FCS school to FBS school, from FBS school down to FCS school. Wherever the playing time or wherever it is that is most personally advantageous to you, you can do that. So not a ton of precedent to see FCS guys make the jump to the Division I level and then immediately be successful. So I think before we get too worked up about the Vernon Adams situation, and even if he is the day one starter at Oregon, like I said, who's to say that making the transition from a place like Eastern Washington to a place like Oregon is going to be as smooth as we assume it is just because Vernon Adams had a really, really successful career in Eastern Washington?
Yeah, I just can't wait for the day that we see a player go from a junior college to Division II program, to FCS, to Oregon, or some program like that, to one at each year. But we'll leave that for another podcast altogether. Thank you so much, guys, for calling in today and talking college football. You can find both Ryan and Dustin on Today's U multiple times a week and on Twitter. Ryan is at Ryan_Wooden, and Dustin is at Sharp_Shooter. That's Shutter. Thanks so much, guys.
Have a good night.
Colin.
See ya. See ya.